Hi there. Come up on the porch. We're just sitting here watching it rain and talking about Louisiana.
I'm Bruce McKee.
And I'm Steve Payne.
And this is the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, episode 318, for June 22nd, 2019.
Welcome back.
This week we finish our interview with Nick Douglas about his kind of a family history, finding Octave. And he saw his ancestor Octave in a sepia-toned photo. Knowing next to nothing about his great-great-grandfather, he started tracing his family line back and found out all kinds of interesting stuff about the family. So we'll be finishing our interview with him in a few minutes. But first, this week in Louisiana history.
So, wow, this is a recent this week in Louisiana history. So on June 22nd, 1983, Louisiana repealed the last of its racial classification laws.
I think
was that like the one drop type laws?
I guess so, and they probably were, you know, although sometimes when you lose a Supreme Court battle, you keep the law on the book. So I guess they were trying to bring us in line with national standards at the time. Now for this week in New Orleans history, June 22nd, 1947, Pistol Pete Maravich was born. And for those of you who don't know, he was a super basketball player.
I saw him play when I was a kid.
Wow.
Yeah, in Baton Rouge when I was growing up. Yeah. Saw him a few times.
Must have been something.
Oh, yeah. He was great. And, of course, the Assembly Center in Baton Rouge is named for him.
Right.
And the Tech one, our Tech Assembly Center, is built on the model of the Assembly Center in Baton Rouge.
Okay.
It's a small, much smaller version of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, now for this week in Louisiana.
So, this week in Louisiana, Beauregard Parish will host the annual Beauregard Watermelon Festival from June 28th to the 29th. This will be 3013 West 1st Street in DeRidder. The number is 337-463-5534. The hours are on our show notes here. They will be on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It looks like mostly in the afternoons and evenings. The contest will feature watermelon carving, seed spitting, and an eating contest. The biggest watermelon contest, a frozen t-shirt contest, is that right?
I guess.
Well,
I don't know
wild.
What that entails. I think you may freeze it in a block of ice and try to get it out or something.
Okay, that's kind of strange. And a watermelon pageant. Oh, that's maybe like a queen will compete for that.
Right.
Or a young woman will compete for that, I guess.
I'm assuming it's the watermelon. Miss Watermelon, although I'm not sure I'd want that title.
Hey, I wouldn't. It wouldn't be too bad if she could spit the seed the farthest, you know?
She's got that hole between her teeth.
Yeah, boy.
Now, postcard from Louisiana. I interview Anonymous for The Voiceless in Jackson Square. They're an animal rights group that frequently protests in various locations. All right, so I'm here in Jackson Square in front of the St. Louis Cathedral talking to Anonymous for the Voiceless, which is a branch of Anonymous that supports animal rights.
That is
Am
correct.
I getting that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
And so y'all are here in Louisiana. You don't have to come here from somewhere else.
Well, most of us that are here today do live here in Louisiana, but we have a few people that came from Alabama and Florida. We have people that come from other
states. Well, I mean, that's Louisiana. We have people come from everywhere. But
yeah.
Last summer I went to a vegan event in one of the parks, I think over on Frenchman Street. But anyway, there is a vegan, movement here in the state. Hard as,
Was it a food fair kind of thing?
Yes,
awesome.
Food fair, music.
Very cool. That's
right, and you go around and,
I'm telling you, food science is really pushing the narrative where we don't have to do this factory farming.
Traditional Louisiana dishes. You can make a meatless gumbo.
Etouffee.
You can make a meatless
you should
red beans and rice.
The vegan etouffee is to die for.
Now that sounds good.
They have faux shrimp. It is great, and it's actually nutrient dense,
right?
So it's good for you instead of
replaces the protein you'd get in shrimp.
Absolutely, you can make them any kind of thing. It's great.
And so you're showing a video of I guess it's mostly fish.
Yeah, this screen here in particular is fish, but we also have different footage on the different screens. Some of them are chickens. We also have beef. We have pigs. And we've also got down and vivisection, laboratory animals and such.
Veal?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's included in the dairy.
Right. Because that's a big one.
Yeah.
So how are y'all doing?
As far as the chapter, as far as the organization
yeah,
goes, we're actually doing really well. I mean, you couldn't really tell from the size
of
the
cube.
It's a pretty good group here.
I think today
on Facebook, you've got how many on the?
We've got about 120 on
120 people on the chapter.
And what's the Facebook page so our folks can find it?
It's AV New Orleans.
AV New Orleans.
Of course, AV stands for Anonymous for the Voiceless.
And that's, okay, good.
Yeah, and they could look us up. They'd have to answer a couple of questions, and then I'd give them an approval. But, yeah, man, like, we started this chapter, the New Orleans chapter, just over a year ago. It was just two people, like cool. A person holding a laptop and one person talking.
I've seen you guys out here before. Mm. This is the first time I've stopped and
talked. We try to do it every couple of months if
yeah.
possible. You know, yeah.
Yeah, the first Saturday of every month is when I come out here and do this.
I think the last time I only saw one screen, so y'all have 1, 2, 3, 4 screens this time. So.
Yeah, it's definitely growing. Like, we started with one screen, we bumped up to two, and then we made some really good friends and some connections, and now this is what we've got so far. We've even got a little tripod in the center so we can get footage.
So is this part of a larger anonymous movement in the area?
In the area, there are a couple of other chapters that are pretty local. Like
yeah.
there's some in Gulfport. I think there's also one in Shreveport. But they're popping up everywhere,
right.
though. New Orleans is the biggest one in Louisiana so far.
I was in Occupy Ruston back in the day.
Oh, Occupy is still going on, which is really great. The
Yellow
Vests are becoming...
still doing my
that's
thing.
Like a, yeah, right. I'm a part of that myself.
Yeah.
The Resist movement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Still there.
I'm still posting.
Mm.
It was... mostly students, and they all graduated, so it's kind of down to me now. But
it does. It becomes, yeah. And that happens,
but, I mean,
you know, with the wax and wane of information.
It's not that Occupy went away. People moved into other things. Like,
sure thing.
Look at what happened in Congress this
correct.
Election. That would not have happened without Occupy.
Exactly the point. Now, there is...
And Anonymous.
Anonymous,
you know, Anonymous has been
exactly
doing good
point.
Work for years.
We show what happens behind the iron gate of
yeah.
factory farming and why, nutriently speaking... You don't have to do this. I mean, you're period. You don't.
Well, and I mean, people risk life and limb to go to work for these places and take.
They do. A lot of immigration issues are. It's human trafficking,
right?
Practically.
And
right.
so they really don't want you in there taking videos.
No, this
yeah.
is a lot of
their laws.
Ag laws, yeah.
Yes,
correct. Agriculture, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
and just showing this, there is something out there that was signed in 1995 called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which means, it states simply, is if you were to disrupt a business of animal agriculture, you were deemed as a terrorist and under a watch group.
Right.
So
even if you're only taking videos and not freeing
correct.
The, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Luckily for us, I'm not sure if it's the same everywhere in the States, but as far as like court, and legal proceedings go, truth is an absolute defense.
Well, yeah, and, I mean, Oprah went through that years ago.
Yeah, that was actually where
and
I learned
she became
about that.
Very healthy.
Right.
And she showed all of her millions of followers, here's what I
and
did
I think
to lose
it was
weight and become healthy, and then, but as
the
it...
The Texas
it were,
had an ag-gag bill, and
they
tried to, you know, stop her, and she they lost
they
big
did.
Time.
They did, yeah. She had the money and the power.
Right. But we still do have a First Amendment.
Right.
You know,
yeah, thankfully, which is what allows us to go into public and speak.
Right.
Like if you get a chance to Google or YouTube, any of the Whole Foods
mm-hmm.
Speak Out is what they're called. Direct Action Everywhere. That's one of the groups that does things of this nature, like we do.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
They are pushing for that.
Well, thank you for your service, guys. And one more time, where can our folks find you?
AV New Orleans on Facebook.
Okay, good. You got a webpage yet?
We don't have a webpage just yet, but we are working on it.
There is the Global Anonymous for the Voiceless on Instagram, and
okay.
also is Facebook as well. Now, those are, again, chapters. The newest ones are just in Hong Kong, which
right.
is pretty
oh, wow.
far away.
Yeah.
Right. Tibet now has a chapter, which I didn't realize, that the Dalai Lama, who, of course, speaks of peace,
oh, yeah.
eats animals. And they've got the Anonymous there talking to and trying to explain this is how
I
it works.
He would have been
I know.
Vegetarian.
It blew my mind as well. I just couldn't believe it. I thought the 13th Dalai Lama, the one that was found
yeah.
and resurrected,
right.
couldn't do it, you know?
Yeah.
So the chapters are everywhere.
I guess that's more of a Hindu thing than Buddhist.
Possibly.
I didn't really
Indians are very...
a lot of them,
right,
right, already
but
there.
But it's strange that if you think of in India, they still have meat sold, so...
Right, there are people eating this
something's happening, right, so...
Well, thank you so much.
I really appreciate it.
It.
Yeah, and I'll be checking out the podcast, of course. I got your
definitely. Yeah, we don't always
forward that to me too.
Do politics, but when we do this, it's progressive.
It kind of goes in. Yeah, it's to skim the surface. And of course, we can continue that elsewhere.
Right.
We can email and, you know,
yeah, totally.
Yeah,
keep in touch.
Yeah.
Now, on to our interview with Nick Douglas.
What's been the reaction of your relatives? I'm really curious about that, since these are. And your story is so personal, and it is really a kind of what we would call a narrative. It's a quest story or a quest narrative, because you're on the hunt to try to discover really who you are, but also who America is. So what's been your family's reaction to all this?
Well, you know, here's one of the sort of tough things that has happened, is that many of my relatives passed into whiteness, which is...
Right. Yeah.
And so I feel very, I mean, you know, personally, I feel very comfortable with that. I think it's a, you know, they had to make some tough decisions about economics or social decisions that they needed to make to maybe get their kid into the right school district or live in the right neighborhood. And so I'm very understanding about that. My family, it has been amazed, and the reason that they've been amazed, and of course they've been appalled as well, because in my research I started highlighting and finding all this information about slavery, and just about how extensive it was, and then of course my free people of color relatives held slaves, and I just put it out there. When I started telling some of my older relatives and older folks who I was also pumping for information that their grandmother or grandfather had held slaves, they were stunned. They were absolutely stunned. They said they never said anything about it. And I said, no, I never would expect them to. Yeah. I mean, you know, what person of color is going to, you know, say that?
I've always been afraid to look too deeply into my own family history, because I'm pretty sure probably some of them did. My family was from South Mississippi, but I did find out something interesting. I was at a family reunion last week, and I was talking to my sister, and I've never been into our family genealogy. Like, I can't process it. She has. And one of our grandmother's grandfather, his last name was Collins. He lived in the little town of Collins, but he went over to Jones County and joined the Free State of Jones. You know, like that movie that Matthew McConaughey was in. And, they seceded from the Confederacy, were loyal to the Union. And she said they would actually go around telling the small farmers, you should be able to live 40 acres in your own labor without having to enslave somebody else. Slavery is wrong. And this is new to me. I had no idea we had a branch of the family that was, involved.
Radicals, in essence, or radicals
at
the time.
Yeah, basically right.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing, we talked about the slavery and everything, and of course people passing into whiteness, and one of the books that I read was One Drop, and the Brouillards. Of course, I'm a relative of Brouillards, and he passed into whiteness. The idea that these relatives, I want to say that they prospered in passing for white, which is a good thing, but. And I'm glad that they did, but the other thing is also, you know, like I say, the Creole side also did very well for themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And it was also because they were never really subject to slavery.
Right.
And so that's also one of the things that I take out of that is, of course, and of course we got reparations. We got reparations from Haiti that we used to sort of get that leg up when we moved to New Orleans. So there's a lot of economic factors that were at play, and a lot of social factors that were at play. And my family, like I say, they were stunned and appalled. But I think that it sort of rounded out the understanding and some of the stories and why people were closed mouthed about things.
Sure, yeah.
And so that really was it really was a good thing. And I went to a family reunion in Toledo Bend a couple of years ago, and it was just really good to see everybody show up. And every color you could ever imagine, a lot of different ages. Filial relationships with people hadn't seen each other in many years. And, a lot of people talked about the book and were very, very happy that I wrote the book. They found out information that they had not known about themselves and their relatives. Some people were exceedingly proud about knowing how our relatives were involved with the civil rights and all these cases that were trying to move everybody forward.
Right.
And then they were also very happy to hear that, you know, how our white kin helped us. And of course, this what happened in Louisiana never would have happened without white kin and white people helping.
Right, on the good side
of things. You know, there were people that were
terrible
allies.
People.
Yeah, but we didn't do this by ourselves. And so, we need to, take that lesson forward. And I think my relatives got it. You know, they got, many people got it. Now, there were some that were upset. And one of the relatives who had passed into whiteness was scared that I was going to tell that he was, he had black ancestry or one drop.
Right.
But I said, well, who would I tell? I mean, this is 2000, and when I did this, it was 2013. I go, 2013, I mean, how am I going to hurt you with that? I don't see it. But he really was worried about it. So I was very in my research and contacting people. I became very careful about how I approach people, and it helped me a little bit because I didn't just stumble into things that I could have. So I thought the whole process was great. I mean, I think more Creoles should read the book because it's really a Creole story, and it's really a story about Louisiana. My family is the vehicle, but people have very similar stories, like the example of going to Mexico. Well, my family went to Mexico, but 100 Creole families went to Mexico. It's not just my family.
Right.
My family was involved with helping Plessy versus Ferguson, but there were countless other people that were involved. I mean, the Comité de Citoyens was 16 people, and then their families were all involved. So, and of course, how did they fund it? They had fundraisers and meetings in all the social clubs and halls in New Orleans, talking up the possibility of getting these discriminatory laws thrown out. So, I think it's a story for a lot of people that come from Louisiana. It's a story to be proud of, I think. And I'm happy that the story found me.
There are several, like, white civil rights activists we've come across in New Orleans. It never occurred to me to wonder if they got into that because they knew they had black relatives that, they don't mention that in their official biography, of why they got into this. But I bet there's a lot more of that than you'd think.
I bet it's a complex of that. And I bought a book here about 5 or 6 months ago, maybe, but it was about Reconstruction and what went on in Louisiana, particularly around New Orleans, but I think it covers this part, the north part of the state too. But anyway, the professor published this thing way back in the 80s when I was finishing college, way back in the mid 80s, and I think he published it through LSU. He might have been a professor at LSU, but anyway, published it through LSU Press, and he uncovered the fact that Louisiana, of all the Deep South states, so you would say Texas, Louisiana, maybe Arkansas, definitely Georgia and Alabama, Florida, South Carolina, that of all those states, Louisiana sent more people to fight for the Union than any other state in the Deep South. That didn't happen in these other states. And it wasn't just African-American Louisianans. It was Anglos. And what he found out was, and this, Bruce and I talked about this off camera or off mic here months ago, that a lot of them were people who were either educated in the North or they were from the North. And so they had these other ties. And, they saw what a secession and what a possible, Confederate victory could have done to this country. And so they believed, at least, and this, you know, and we have to distinguish between people that were pro-unionists and people that were abolitionists, because it doesn't necessarily coincide. There were people mm-hmm. who were fighting for the union that were strongly racist, quite frankly. But this being said, I mean, these were people that did believe in the union, and they went to, and it was about a huge number of people. I think it was like maybe 14,000 African-American Louisianans and 8,000 Anglos, which was incredible. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine? That didn't happen again in the rest of the Deep South. It just didn't happen. It didn't happen in Mississippi. It didn't happen in Arkansas. It didn't happen in mm-hmm. Texas. It happened here. And most of them, again, coming probably from the New Orleans area, or and their families having been from up north, or they were educated in the north, where they had those connections and they saw, again, what secession, you know, the potential destruction that that could bring to this country.
Yeah.
So, it makes for a very complicated state, again, you know, not just racially, but also ideologically, at least at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's always been complicated. It's been complicated from the very beginning. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think it would ever have succeeded without cooperation. I mean, starting from the first French settlers and the Native Americans, you know, they had to cooperate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's just it's a continuum as far as I'm concerned, as far as Louisiana is concerned.
They all kind of fit with each other, I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Back
to what you were talking about, people passing, we've got it was an English composition essay written, amazingly, written by this young man named Jari Honora, who is a mm-hmm. genealogist working in New Orleans.
Was he the Tulane student?
Yeah, yeah, it was his mm-hmm. freshman English class at Tulane. But anyway, he, as a genealogist, gets these emails from people. In his case, he was talking about somebody from California, and she didn't know anything about her family. Like, they'd always been real, very tight-lipped. And he said, when initially writing to her, I had a strange premonition she was, quote-unquote, white. Mm-hmm. All the clues were present. A query from a Californian with an unfamiliar surname who wrote of her grandparents with a vagueness somehow not in keeping with the seemingly omniscient picture one paints of a beloved grandparent. So it was his job when he was 16-year-old, basically, to tell her who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's this, you know, grandmother who felt like something clicked into place now. And, you know, it gives my life an explanation of who I am. And it was a really profound moment. And I imagine your book has done that for a lot of your family members, the ones that didn't know the history.
Yeah, the ones that didn't know the history, I mean, they have been effusive in contacting me and thanking me about that. And you know, like I say, I'm very understanding about the reasons that behind people making those decisions and maybe not
sure.
telling their children.
Right.
And you know, recently I had a relative, and you know, also I'll say this, there are relatives who are still struggling with the whole issue.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I for me, you know, I'm of course a Creole color. I couldn't say I was white. I mean, people
right, right, right.
If I said I was white. So, but to these relatives who've been passing as white, and sort of not actually looking real white, but their relatives look more white than they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and because of the shuffling of the DNA, they
right,
they,
right,
they
exactly.
look more black, right?
Well, yeah, that becomes as the gene pools are mixed more and more, you're going to see, you know, varying shades of, you know, darkness or lightness or whatever among, you know, the offspring.
Yeah, and it just comes out that certain generations it's going to mm-hmm. present itself, and other generations it's not going to present itself. And so I find the sort of 30-year-old. You know, I call them kids, but 30-year-olds who are finding out now. Yeah, but I'm finding that they're struggling a lot more now because they've grown up with this whole different mindset about discrimination and racism,
mm-hmm.
and so now to have to try to deal with this and, you know, sort of I guess reconcile themselves with the story that they've been told that wasn't true. Is very
mm-hmm.
hard for them, you know.
Right.
So I think that's been the sort of surprising thing for me. even like I say in 2018, 2013, when I wrote the book, that people were still, you know, just mightily struggling with this race thing. And
I think it's
really
clearer now than it was then. I mean, that was the era of Obama, and the era of racism in America is over. And I don't know that anybody believes that at this point anymore. You know?
Oh yeah, God,
you know,
gracious,
we're
yeah.
right back in it, man. Just as you know,
well, you know, to talk about all this, and this is not to trivialize your research, much less your final product in the book, but that motif. What did I hear it called? It was something like everything you've been told is a lie. That became popular of all places in comic books. And I used to be, and I don't collect many anymore. Really, Bruce and I both were comic book readers as kids, and I got back into collecting them in grad school, and you know, just when, you know, would read them. They've gotten so expensive nowadays I can't afford them, so I quit. But that became a very, very prevalent motif back, really back in, I think, in the 90s, maybe the 80s and 90s up through the early 2000s, this everything you know is a lie kind of motif. I mean, it clearly doesn't go away. You know, people have to wrestle with questions of identity. In particular, that's what it particularly swirls around, is who am I?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all doing that every day of the world, you know, who am I? And so it has to be kind of a shocker to find out, you know, hey, these are my ancestors and nobody ever told me this.
Yeah, and you know, it's I mean, people always had indicates, like certain relatives of mine have had indications that they had relatives of the darker persuasion, but they could never really put their finger on it. And then you know, when somebody like I wrote this book, they found out. They said, okay, there was their aha moment. They said, okay.
Right, right.
Now I know. Now I know what the deal is. And for whatever reasons, they were given, for people acting that way or telling them that story, they were able to reconcile that. And like I say, the 30 something are seem to be the people that are hardest to reconcile it. For me, you know, I remember, you know, one of my first childhood memories was, a segregation moment where we were not served in a restaurant, and
right.
I understand what that was all about, and I understand the sting of that. But you know, the 30-something, those kids will rarely ever have that happen to them. I mean, it should never happen, but you know,
it still happens, but it's not backed up by the law usually.
Exactly. So they're really upset that they, you know, that people would have misled them all this time. So, you know, I hope that, you know, I didn't want to make it a book about race because, I didn't want to interject myself too much into it because the story has a great flow all the way through history and all the way
right.
to my generation. And so I wanted to just, you know, follow the story and not get off the tangent because there were people that did all these wonderful things. And you know, I had a great section in there about the jazz musicians that were in my family. And of course,
right.
they passed as white to play with white musicians. You know, for example, I remember as a kid, Jimmy Durante had a variety show, you know, and I never knew that Jimmy Durante was from New Orleans. I remember he had,
I did not either.
Yeah. He had a band, and he was a piano player and singer, and people loved the way he sang. But he had Achilles Baquette, who was a clarinet player who passed for white to play with him. And Achilles Baquette lived in the same neighborhood as my relatives, the Pavageaux. So, in New Orleans we had this back and forth of.
Right.
People just passing over the color line, passing back and forth across the color line, white people just ignoring all the rules and
right.
being with black people. I mean, it just, it was just such an unusual place, and it still is. And so I'm trying to promote this as outside of the New Orleans family, you know, and the Louisiana family. Because
have you tried to put in local New Orleans bookstores? I imagine there'd be a market for it.
Yeah, I put it in bookstores. Of course, it's available on Amazon.
Right.
But But, you know, I'm spreading out here in California because, you know, we have a big Creole community in Los Angeles.
True, yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and we have our big, you know, and we have a big Mardi Gras festival here. And so, you know, I'm definitely moving it here to this part of the country because
mm-hmm.
It's important just to get the message out. And it's a, like I say, it's, I think it's a unique story. And of course I'm going to say that because I wrote it, but I think that when you look around, it doesn't, there are other stories that tell portions of the same story.
Right.
And many, many people have a story similar but not as contiguous as that
right.
story.
Yeah, and it's the combination of the details and your treatment of your characters and all that makes it unique. It makes it uniquely yours. I'm wondering, have you looked around? You know, there's a large, really a very large population of African and European people who are of French descent around the Houston area because it's so close to, you know, Southwest Louisiana. They moved down there particularly, I think, from the 40s on up, you know, because mm-hmm. of the oil and gas industry down there.
Well, and then Katrina redoubled that.
Katrina did that, too.
That were able to come.
Yeah,
through.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, have you tried to place it in bookstores around the Houston area? Because there's a community like that on there.
My relatives, I have many Creole relatives in Dallas and Houston area. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I know that's a place for it. And you know,
so,
like,
yeah,
like
say, a big audience, I think, too.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, they, like I said, they share many of the same stories that I share in my book. So, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm you know, so thankful that you guys, you know, call me for the interview. But I think it's also just a larger picture and a better picture of the United States rather than
mm-hmm.
being this stupid, you know, kind of me, and let's keep everybody out and we hate everybody
mm-hmm.
that's not
oh my gosh,
this
yeah.
kind of American.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we look at Louisiana and we say, well, you know, look, they accepted all these different kinds of people, mixes of every kind of people. And, you know,
it's one of the world's great cities. It hasn't made it worse. It's made it better.
Yes, yes.
You know?
And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, and so, you know, until that, until people start to understand it a little bit more, I think it's, you know, very misunderstood. And some of the things that, like I say, that come out of it, like the you know, one of the things that really just riles me, to no end is the quadrant and octoroon, mythology and Poissage
right,
mythology
right.
comes out. And then the other thing is about the story about Henrietta de Lisle and these free women of color. And I think that's,
I think I've heard that story. What is it?
Well, you know, that Henrietta de Lisle had that she was being groomed to be a place, and
she's a nun.
She's venerated at this point. She's
right,
I guess they're still working on finding her miracles. But my thing is that you know, the story that came out about her saying that she actually had a sort of a place relationship with this man and had two children, I guess, that died, without one shred of proof that's true.
Right.
It really sullies the whole her whole history and the fact that she created this order of free women of color who served not only aged slaves but orphaned black children and opened up one of the earliest old folks' homes, and they're still doing good deeds today.
And one of our previous guests was talking about her and said, a woman like that with those kind of talents, she could have done any number of things in New Orleans.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the choice of the nonary or a Poissage relationship.
And New Orleans was a place that women could do that.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Maybe still can.
Yeah, it still can. That's exactly right. Yeah, but
which makes it sound suspiciously like a case of character assassination in order to destroy her legacy, right?
Suspiciously
sounds like that.
You go in Dookie Chase's restaurant, and there's Miss Leah
hugging President Obama. You know, people come from around the world to eat her fried chicken. And they made a movie with her as a Disney princess. The one set in New Orleans. What's the name of it? Princess and the Frog, maybe, or something like that. And you know, she's the model of a character in a Disney movie. It's just, you know, you can't underestimate what women like that can do. And it's not just, okay, my only option. It was probably an act of devotion on her part. This is what I feel called to do.
That was the point, you know. And so, yeah, very interesting. And like I say, as long as we sort of minimize that story, then it doesn't resonate throughout. If we minimize and suppress. Now think of all the years that all the goings on in New Orleans have been suppressed.
Right.
And so if we don't now amplify this, now that we've got sort of a platform to talk about it and say, hey, this is why it was unique, and this is all that came out of this unique place, then we're really doing a disservice to the legacy and to the city. I mean, and to the city and area itself. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right? Totally.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not an accurate view of American history when people leave out those particular stories, and then the interpretation of them, which gives their significance or their meaning. All right, so they have to be told. I mean, those stories need to be told by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is how Stephen and I got into the Louisiana Anthology Project. Became concerned that Louisiana literature and books and stuff isn't taking its rightful place. We have great authors. You can't make it to school in Mississippi without reading some Faulkner. But you can definitely go all the way through school in Louisiana, and maybe the only Kate Chopin story you read is The Story of an Hour, which is not Louisiana-ish at all. You know?
Or you read The Awakening, you know, like I did in school. But that's
maybe.
About it.
I mean, it would be great if they read that, but I didn't. They didn't assign it to me. So anyway, we started the anthology, and a year later we started the podcast so we could interview people doing this interesting research into Louisiana. And, you know, so we could tell these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And neither one of us trained as what they call Southernists, which would be a person that either studied Southern literature or Southern history. Neither one of us trained that. I mean, Bruce trained in classical lit, and I trained in neoclassical lit. But we fell into the project.
Yeah, nobody was doing it. So, you know, you just kind of, okay, well, this needs doing, and if you wait around,
we rolled up our sleeves.
Yeah.
You're going to do it. You guys have to do it. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
Yeah.
You know, you wait.
And it's transferable. It's transferable in the sense that, you know, you could have somebody that's, say, living up here in Oklahoma, you know, not terribly far, you know, above the 33rd parallel, above Streetport and so forth. Well, some bunch of Oklahomans might want to do Oklahoma literature, or somebody up in Minnesota might want to do Minnesota literature, or over in North Carolina or whatever. Again, the project itself, the basis of it, could be transferred to other states rather easily and just look at their own unique literary culture.
Right. I'm sure they must write something in those places. But
oh, absolutely.
Not nearly as cool as what Louisiana has.
Yeah, I agree.
But it is transferable, like a lot of these projects like this are, I think.
Well, I first heard about, you know, the lack of Louisiana pushing its literature. People know about our music, they know about our food, to some degree our
architecture.
A little bit about the culture, you know, the music. I think I may have mentioned that. They don't know the literature, and I had a professor mention that in 1988. About 25 years later, I was still telling that story, and Stephen said, well, you know, we ought to do an anthology. And I was like, I didn't mean me. But he wore me down, so we've been doing it ever since.
Well, and then the podcast was the same story. I mean, I write fiction, and there were two guys that they've since canceled their show with 200 episodes, because one of the fellows is in pretty failing health up here in Arkansas. But but they had interviewed me twice or three times, I guess, on their show before they, you know, long before they pulled the plug on the thing. And And I got them off mic, and we talked, and I told Bruce before we did it, this was 6 years ago, this June, actually, was when this all happened, when we finally got started. And I said to Bruce, I'm going to ask those guys when they bring me on, and this was probably about, you know, March or April or May of 6 years ago, and I said, I'm going to ask them what they do for their podcast. And they were well into theirs at the time. They were probably a good, I'm thinking, maybe 3 years into it, because I think they went five years or 6 years, and they killed it. Well, anyway, I asked them what they did in terms of, you know, equipment and types of guests they brought on and their approach to the subject matter and everything. But one of the things that they both said that stuck with both of us was this. When you get started, you need to develop a regular schedule so that people will follow you week to week or you won't develop any momentum. And so we've been putting out new content, as they say, every week for 6 years.
We just crossed 300 episodes. So we've already come across two people that you know that we've interviewed, and that's not unusual. There are a lot of people working, and there are a lot of connections that people have.
And one more that you know of is Isabel Wilkerson, the Pulitzer winner. So, we've got connections literally all over the United States, even though we're based here in Louisiana, even though most of our writers are in Louisiana. We get people from outside, like her, who are writing as historians, you see, and tracing the stories of people.
I have been surprised at the number of people in California we've wound up interviewing. There's a large diaspora of Louisiana people out there where you are, so and they're doing interesting work in studying Louisiana.
One of the things that, you guys are talking about how you got involved with this, And so, my thing is that there's a lot of, instead of the sort of current story that we hear about scarcity. So if somebody gets something, you lose something. I look at Louisiana and Louisiana history and Louisiana genealogy as bounty. Stories have not even been looked into, and the more people that get into it, the better and more information we'll have. And so we'll have a more complete view rather than a less complete view, because there's bounty in this. I mean, there are stories that, think of all the white families that have stories that they haven't told about their black family, right? Think about that. Maybe some of those people are afraid to do that. Maybe this podcast or your podcast or my book will get them to thinking, hey, I can finally tell my story. One of the things that came out of this was you talked about Jeremy Simeon, who I do YouTube videos with. He finds paintings and pictures and documents all over the place. He does his homework and he searches the internet. He's had to be a
detective like Bruce and I. That's what we keep saying. We're literary detectives of the sort.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
He told us he gets up every morning and looks at old pictures for sale.
And so what we talk about is we're going like, that now that things are changing, and things are opening up. Maybe these sort of white kin who have been afraid to say anything about their black connection will look under the bed and find that picture that we've been waiting for, the picture of Homer Plyce or something.
Or they've been walking by it all their lives.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
On the wall.
And so it's only when you think about everything being bountiful and that there's no scarcity, because we want more people to come into this space. You don't want less people to come into this space. You want more people to come into the space. You want more people talking about this. And it expands the whole the whole reservoir of knowledge, and that's what we're really after. And so I encourage people to write stuff, and I encourage people to share, because it's so important, and I learn something every time. I learn something every time I talk to someone. So
did you guys, you and Simeon, do a YouTube video about quadroons and Plissage. Okay, I have seen that. I've watched it.
And that's my beautiful face. That's my beautiful
face. Yeah, the little drop. It took a while, but...
Yeah, Yeah, and you know, we try to do these videos because we feel like the story that's getting out there. I mean, you know, the story about the quadrant balls. You know, we went through it, and I wrote an article on this blog called Afropunk about just dissecting advertisement, one of the only advertisements I had ever seen,
right,
with quadrant
right.
ball. And
I showed it on that video.
Yeah. Yeah, and I dissected that and said, you know, hey, this doesn't make any sense from what I know about Louisiana history. And, of course, we know that the guy who was putting on that ball was a scoundrel and a slaveholder, a slave trader that came from the north to exploit what was going on in Louisiana. So, you know, having that information out there will amplify the whole history of Louisiana, and so the more people that come in, the more people that write books, the more people you guys interview, the better it is for everybody, because it puts Louisiana in context. And Louisiana, some of the things you guys were talking about, like, you know, hey, it sent the most soldiers to the Union side of all the
Deep South, yeah,
all
right.
The Deep South, yeah. Think about that. I mean, people don't even realize that. And hey, Louisiana is the only place to have a black governor. It's Pinchback. He only served for a month. But
yeah, there's a guy. It's funny you say that. There's a guy from New Orleans. He is a historian teaching up here above us in Little Rock. He's at UA Little Rock, and mm-hmm. I've tried to find the guy's email, and I can't seem to find it. But he, let me tell you another story that's related to the Pinchback story. At the time, when he was a kid going through school, one of his professors or one of his teachers, because he was, probably a grade school, high school kid down in New Orleans, and his teacher said something about, we've never had a black lieutenant governor. He said, that's not true. And his teacher looked at him and tried to argue. Well, it turned out he is related to the United States' first black lieutenant governor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember what the man's name was. This is not
Oscar Dunn.
Somebody else.
Oscar
maybe,
Dunn.
It may be.
Yeah.
It's awesome. And I cannot dig this guy up for anything, because I think he has written some stuff on that man's life. I think some mm-hmm. articles, some journal articles, because, again, he is a historian. And mm-hmm. I wish we could snare him, you know, throw out the net, as I said, and catch the fish. But I wish he would mm-hmm. be the fish we could catch, because I cannot come up with his email address.
Mm-hmm.
And he's bound to be reachable through University of Arkansas Little Rock campus, you know, probably through campus information. But mm-hmm. I really, when I stumble up on him, honestly, I was typing in some stuff about, I think, about Louisiana and political history and that kind of thing. I think that was how he came up. But when mm-hmm. I saw it, I said, wow, this is a revelation, you know. And I found him maybe 5 or 6 months ago. It was back maybe in the fall, you know, first part of the winter. So it's been probably back to maybe August or September, maybe October.
Yeah.
So, I may have studied the guy way down. And I took the Louisiana history that all the kids have to take in eighth grade, but I took another one in high school. We had an honors Louisiana history class, I think it was a half a year, and it did modern Louisiana history of the 20th century, and so
mm-hmm.
I took that thing. But so I think that's probably where I missed him, because he would have been a 19th century lieutenant governor, so I missed
mm-hmm.
him.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I took, you know, college-level history, college-level American history, and I never learned any of this stuff. I never learned any of the stuff that I found out from researching my book. And it's a completely different U.S. history, you know, and you know, why was it not promoted? Well, because it was suppressed, because it tells of a different kind of story than what people feel real comfortable with.
Right. Square with the dominant worldview. You know, our professor, Dr. Cook, faced this in terms of regional history down at LSU before he went off to Georgia to do his PhD. He was at LSU, and he said to one of his professors, and I think it was in a Louisiana history class, quote, why don't you ever cover North Louisiana? And he said, not a damn thing happened up there. Well, what they didn't know, he was totally neglecting Natchitoches, the oldest settlement in the Louisiana Purchase,
mm-hmm.
European
mm-hmm.
settlement.
But yeah.
He also, at the time, didn't know about Poverty Point, which is the only, you know, UN World Heritage Site, probably in the whole Louisiana Purchase. You know, it's this old, you know, I don't say prehistoric, but it's, you know, it is definitely from before the Common Era, maybe 800 or so, 700 BC, something like that. But, I mean, it's a really, really ancient Native American site over in the
mm-hmm.
Delta.
Yeah.
And they probably had not done any archaeological digs, frankly, to, you know, to show all that stuff at the time, back in the 60s or whatever. But you get the point. I mean, you've got to go and do these digs and do this, like you're doing, searching documents in order to unearth this information.
Yeah, and, you know, you're finding all these nuggets, and, And then, you know, like I say, I couldn't have made up my story. My story just, like I say, found me. And you know, because it was such a continuous story throughout Louisiana history, I said I gotta get this done. I originally started the book as just a family album or sort of a family history lesson that I was going to bring to my family reunion, and it blossomed into a whole lot more.
I have an aunt who has written a book about my mom's side of the family, the Spell family, but it's just for the you know, she mimeographed it and put holes in it and put in like binders, and that's how we got it. Although now it's on the internet, so you can go and look it up. Put it online.
And that's exactly how I was thinking about my book, and then I started realizing, oh no, this is a bigger story than just you know, my family, something for my family reunion. So, you know, people need to start thinking in that way, and you know, just getting this information out there. Like I say, I just feel like I've, you know, scratched the surface on some of the stuff that happened around my relatives.
Your book weaves it all together, like. The one she has is more or less, you know, this ancestor did this, and this one did that, and she wasn't trying to make a coherent, like, a history of a family, which is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I had two families that I really followed through all the way through Louisiana history, and that kind of helped me. I could kind of dodge between the two families and connect them and dodge back to between the two families. And it made it made the flow a little bit easier for me. I think, you know, there are spots where I don't, like, you know, one of the things that I say, and I'm really fervent about, is that if you don't know something and you don't have the facts behind it to back everything up, just don't put it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have an editor who was like, he said, where's the proof to this? If you say this, you have to have some proof. Now, if you want to say your opinion, you say your opinion. But you're putting it in this book, and you're asking me to copy edit it, you need to have some documented proof or some evidence that shows that this actually happened. And so, I'm subject to fits of fancy. So luckily, I had him, you know, reel me back in and say, no, you can't do this. And you know, I think that makes it better for me, because I had proof of everything that I did, and things that I didn't know, I didn't talk about, because I didn't have anything that I could say that made any sense about it, you know.
I read somewhere that in America everybody is descended from an Indian princess, and ours is Pocahontas, and I had this uncle that traced the other side of the family back to the 12 tribes, and you know, we're part of the Lost Tribes of Israel, and somewhere along in there, I wonder where, like, how far back can you trust this? And then, you know, where does it go, like, depart? And you don't know what to trust.
I mean, you know, I look at that as a situation, say, for my African relatives, right? My African ancestors. I know where they came from. And I know maybe the tribe that they were listed, that was listed from them. But that's it. That's where I run aground.
You're dead end, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I can start from there, but I can't go any further.
Have you had a chance to visit Africa and try to meet people from those original tribes?
Well, I visited the northern part of Africa. I was in Tunisia years and years ago, but I haven't gone to Senegal, which I know where my relatives are from Senegal. So, you know, that's one of my, touch points on my bucket list to do that. Because I understand they have a fabulous African history museum in Senegal. So, I'm definitely, you know, thinking along those terms, but. You know, that's where, like, a lot of the genealogy ran out for me. And you know, some of the people that came to Saint-Domingue, you know, I didn't have information on where they came from before they got
right.
down to me. So I couldn't really expand on the story. And so I had to leave it at that. But, you
there
know.
These question marks. You go back.
Yeah, they're home. Question marks. Yeah. And I can, you know, try to research them, but, you know, there may not be a lot of information available. And, you know, for most slaves and most people of African American descent, people weren't real careful about the records that they kept, other than
right.
making sure that, of course, the slave holdings were always very well kept after. But
right.
Other records may not be as well kept, and so you know you have to I don't want to say make assumptions, but you know you have to, if you don't have the information, you have to just be satisfied. Well, I'm not going to get this information.
Well, you know, after the Great Fire of what was it, 1788. In New Orleans.
Yeah, because you just posted the stuff about that, I think, on the
King
on the
ordered
Facebook page of the website.
The King ordered the governor to build a fire-resistant room to keep records in. And so, you know, New Orleans has a lot of records that other places in the country don't, which is kind of surprising given all the flood and fire and famine that's going on.
Yeah, and I was super lucky. I mean, I consider myself to be just blessed because the French were degenerate bureaucrats. They wrote down everything.
Right,
and
the Spanish,
Spanish
like that too. They were like, yeah, really obsessive compulsive about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, empires, and empires thrive on paperwork. You know, it's all about the bureaucracy, man.
Yeah. And like I say, luckily they kept records on slaves and when they came from what tribes and so that really put me way ahead of the game as far as being able to research my African ancestors.
And
which is,
the church kept records too, because you know one of the first laws or first paragraphs in the Code Noir was that the slaves must be Catholic, and so
they must be baptized. Exactly.
Yeah. And you got to keep records.
And it's the slave master's responsibility to baptize them. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's another thing. I heavily counted on the Archdiocese of New Orleans, the sacramental records that they kept. And so that of course helped me.
Digitized, or did you have to go back to old books and?
I actually went into New York and went to the New York Library and got the 19 volumes and went through the 19 volumes.
Oh, wow.
but they are digitized. I know people have digital copies of them. I know you can get digital copies of them. But I didn't do that. But, yeah.
Sometimes digital copies are rather wretched, and you can't tell what you can tell from the original, you know. They aren't that good. You know, sometimes the modern ones are high def and all, but we've got some old microfilms that are just awful to try to read.
Oh, that's Liberty for Louisiana. That,
oh, my goodness.
It's one of the first plays we think was produced in English in the state of Louisiana. it dates back to the days of a territory, American territory, I think 1804, 1806, something like that. So it's over, a little over 200 years old, and it's... It was a digitized copy of a microfilm that they sent me when I was finally able to track the thing down for us and so we could stick it into the website. I mean, it's pretty faded and degraded in places, and you have to really try to reconstruct the facts.
The guy that wrote it is a kind of a politician-type guy named James.
Yeah, he was a judge. He was a judge in New Orleans.
And he had a proposal, which was that the United States should free all the slaves and then allow them to relocate to the Louisiana Purchase to have land and build a society. Very radical stuff for the crack of, you know, the turn of the 19th century. I wish we had more by him. I think we've got a couple of books we're working on, but
yeah, he did a book of, yeah, he was a, probably one of the only examples of a Federalist writer that lived in Louisiana, because this is towards the end of the Federalist period when that party is dying, and he writes a whole book of essays. That may be what you're talking about. One of them is a book of essays he wrote, and and maybe some legal documents too. I'm not sure, but anyway, he was a kind of a legal theorist and political theorist too. And so he's this Irish immigrant. So he himself is an outsider. He comes here from Ireland, immigrates to, I think, South Carolina, and then very quickly after he writes that play, he hops a boat, I think, in Charleston. He comes right to New Orleans. I mean, it was right after that he wrote the play, maybe within 2 or 3 years of it. So before we became a state, it's around 1806 or 7 or 8, he comes down here to New Orleans and lives out the rest of his life, or most of the rest of his life here in South Louisiana.
And he got caught up in the Burr conspiracy. It's amazing how everything's connected, you know, like what kind of guy is that? we've been finding these interesting early records that go way back, but sometimes they aren't. You know, Stephen tracked that one down. I don't know how he did it, but it's been buried.
Well, I found it in a book I wrote. There was It was a book that I read. It was about Southern drama, and his name came up in the days of early, I think they called it early Republican drama, but anyhow, it was the drama after the United States was separated after the Revolution.
We recently got it on the website after several years of working on it. And so for the first time in two centuries, it's generally available and not just in a, you know, microfilm in the basement of a library somewhere. So, you know, making this stuff available is kind of what we want to do. And it seems like what you're doing, too, with your research.
Yeah, I'm sharing as much as I can. I mean, I presented at the Miami International Book Festival, and I'm doing stuff. I'm definitely going. I'm sort of a private person, but I'm definitely going outside my comfort zone. And you know, I'm encouraging like Jeremy Simeon, to share all the treasures that he's got. I mean, he has a fabulous collection of Creole of color art and documents.
Right.
And they're museum quality. They need to be in a museum somewhere, or need to be in a traveling display that goes around the country and sort of lets people understand about the unique history that came out of Louisiana and how it's affected every part of the United States.
I mean, right. It would be nice to have a museum in New Orleans, hopefully on the second floor.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's way past time that New Orleans kind of take its rightful place as far as some of the leadership that it's provided to the United States, and you know, just moving the whole thing forward. And I'm not just talking about race, but I'm just talking about just moving the United States forward.
Well, some years ago, the British Museum or British Library was downsizing its holdings, sold off many, many years of the Times-Picayune. And a guy from New Orleans eventually bought it. Is it Joseph Makos? Is that his name?
Yeah, J.S. Mm-hmm. Makos, whatever, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're back, you know, and the Times didn't keep a copy of all its papers. And it's just a vast difference between a paper you can hold in your hands and it's in color versus an old black and white microfilm. So he's trying to get permanent housing for that. So, you know, I think there are people out there that see the value of this, finding the money to, you know, protect these things and make them available to the public is what's tricky.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that, that I always am talking about are pictures, photographs. And we have, you know, Aristide Daliet, who was a photographer of Creoles of color in particular. Many of my relatives went to Dalia to get their pictures taken.
Right.
And, he evidently had thousands of pictures of Creoles of color, and those pictures were purchased, or the plates were purchased by one person. And I guess, you know, every now and then one of those Dalia pictures will surface and it'll be sold for $1,000 or so. But
right.
there's one person that really literally has, you know, thousands of pictures of Creoles
of
color.
So he's just sitting on the pictures pretty much? Or not,
yeah, he's just sitting on the pictures, and every now and then he wants to sell one, he'll sell one for $1,000 or so.
He needs a little money.
He needs a little money. Yeah.
Have you made contact?
Well, I tried to find out who it was because I was so interested, and I knew there was. Of course, Louisiana State Museum has about 9 years or so pictures that were done by Dahlia that that people have turned in who they didn't know who the people were.
Right. Simeon said that a lot of these, there's no idea who's in the photograph. You just know
the
type of person and about the time, like where they would have been in society, and the rest, you know, is a mystery.
Yeah, but evidently an auction house got his whole portfolio, and one person bid and bought it some years ago, and you know, those pictures have not surfaced. But that's, I mean, you know, that you're talking about a literal, you know, cornucopia of the history of New Orleans captured on photographic medium that's not out there.
We've got all of these museums, all of these universities in New Orleans and Baton Rouge as well that could have bid on that. You think, what a loss to Louisiana that we didn't get this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you had that thing that you found, Bruce, in our library at Tech, of all places. It was that book. Was it a novel? But anyhow, was it Guy?
Yeah.
But anyhow, it's one of the few copies of that book around that even survives. But it's one of the only accounts of the first college created in Louisiana, and I guess it would have been in the Louisiana Purchase, but it was at College of Orleans.
It was 1805, 1806. It was a thinly veiled autobiography, and so it's a great look back into early 19th century New Orleans. And he describes just the way it was. You know, like I say, it's fictionalized a bit, but not much.
And the college died, I mean, after not too long a period of time. But it would have been, you know, had it survived, it would have celebrated its 200th birthday probably about 12 to 14 years ago, which is pretty phenomenal. I mean,
They hired a French scholar to be the president. It turned out that he was one of these radical atheists from the Revolution. The proper mothers of these young men that were going to school there pulled their kids out because they weren't going to truck with such nonsense, and the school died.
It killed the school, see?
Yeah.
But again, of all places, where would you expect to find a copy of that book? You'd think Tulane or LSU, and no, it was here at Tech. I mean, Tech actually had a copy of it in the special collection.
Yeah, I found out about the book, and I started searching for it, and here it is right under my nose, and Stephen, for all these years, you know, right there sitting on the book. But it's on the 7th floor of a North Louisiana library, so hopefully it'll be safe. You worry about stuff that's preserved in South Louisiana, because what's the next flood going to do to it?
I hope they've learned their lesson from Katrina, because, you know, people lost priceless documentation during that time. I hope that people have realized that they need to take some precautions.
Well, I heard they built back the infrastructure to hopefully withstand a Category 3. So the next 5 that comes through, it's going to be bad news all over again. Oh, man, the weather's getting worse. There are more and more Category 5. So, you know, eventually a 5 will hit, so prepare for the 5. But, you know, and I don't blame New Orleans. I blame the Bush administration. Because, you know, that's what they wanted to pay for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could have done it up right, yeah. So.
Right. Had a chance to do it right, but
going back to Johnson, because my cousin, a younger cousin of mine, did his dissertation at Tulane about the failures of the various presidential administrations, but all the way back to Johnson and Hurricane Betsy, of the slipshod, you know, methods that they used, but also the poor building materials that they used to construct those levees and so forth. And, I mean, he goes through that in his dissertation, and eventually he got it published as a book.
And on the other hand, you've got
this pretty blistering, I think.
You've got this pump system that goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. That stuff's awesome. You know, as long as you can get power to it, you can, and the levee is not broken, you can drain the city. You know, there'll be floods, but it won't be a standing water for very long. They're pumps bigger than anybody's ever seen. people are just amazed when they see it at work. But you got to have the levee and you got to have electricity or the pumps don't do any good.
I'm curious about this photographer that you mentioned. Has anybody ever done a biography of him? Are you aware of anything? Or
no, I'm not. And he was, like I say, the main photographer of Creoles of Color. And he had a shop on 33 Frenchman Street for maybe 40 years. Many of my relatives went, and in my book you'll see the Dallier photographic images. They went to get pictures of him, and I think many prominent Creoles of Color went to get their picture taken by him. And so it's very disheartening for me to know that somebody has maybe some incredible historical photograph. Maybe the picture of Homer Plessy. Maybe the picture of Paul Tervain. Maybe the picture of J.B. Rudinet, who we don't know. They're holding on to this, and they don't realize that they're holding a picture that's of great historical importance and value.
Right.
To people, and simply because they just don't know. As far as I know, there hasn't been anything written about him, and I think it's probably worth doing.
Totally.
Yeah,
there's in the same vein, because I'm into films as a hobbyist. I don't shoot them or anything, but I'm just into film narrative because I got turned onto it in high school and college. But there was a book I saw right here in the Lincoln Parish Library, of all places, and I think it was about New Orleans on film or something, but they had, at least part of the book was, it may have been about photography too, but I think it was about New Orleans capture on film, and it was dating back to around 1900, so it was well over 100 years ago, during the early days of motion picture technology, of, you know, somebody, or some bodies, it may have been multiple people, but they had cameras, and they were shooting, you know, footage of New Orleans there, camera footage or motion picture footage of New Orleans. And it's pretty remarkable, if you could get somebody that's got that kind of thing, too, because that's going to capture, wherever that camera went, that's going to capture all kinds of images of the city, circa, say, 1900, 1910. So some really valuable records, I think, of what the city was like.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, like I say, I'm not disheartened because little by little these things are surfacing,
right?
You know, and it's just being there at the right time and right place where this shows up.
Totally.
And maybe at some point he'll start auctioning off these things. You know,
yeah.
You never know.
Well, the family will want to get rid of it when he passes away. What's all this?
Yeah, yeah.
Sell it
yeah.
and get rid of it. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I see we've been going a couple hours. Have we missed anything you would like to mention before we get off the phone?
No. I really appreciate you guys just talking to me. I think this has been great. I hope you guys. I mean, it sounds like you guys have enjoyed the book, which is really what I'm, grateful for.
I started reading it last night. So,
did you?
Yes, I did.
And it's what I keep saying to people, if not in person, like we got you on the phone, but also after we do our intros and outros and post those each week. I mean, people are doing valuable work, whether it's writing a volume of poetry or whether it's writing a family story, a biography, or whether it's shooting a film. I mean, this is valuable work that needs to be publicized, I think, for the wider public to hear about it.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Recently we talked to a woman who started investigating her grandfather. He was one of those out in California. I knew the family came from Louisiana, but not a whole lot else. As an adult, she found out her grandfather was lynched in Shreveport.
Yeah, Shira Dedman, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She and her aunt and her mother made a pilgrimage back to Shreveport, the tree where it happened. And, you know, it was just profoundly moving, but also very
upsetting. They shot a film, too, didn't they, Bruce? Didn't they shoot
a
movie?
Yeah, it's a short... Yeah, you know, there's a museum that deals with it, and they have lots of jars that hold about a gallon of dirt, and, you know, they get dirt collected from all these places where these lynchings took place. It's a memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put out the video, I'm having a 5 or 10 minute documentary of them doing that research. It's very, really profound. But, you know, that was when she found out, oh, this is why we moved, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they moved well before your relatives did. I think it was 1905, 1910. It was at the dawn of the 20th century. I mean, they cut out. I'm guessing they probably hopped the train, but, I mean, they cut out just as soon as that lynching went down before they, but listen, they packed their bags.
They left town, yeah.
Yeah. Newport was busy earning the nickname Bloody Caddo at the time. So, you know, it was a bad place.
It was Alabama or Georgia or Texas in miniature. I mean, South Louisiana was bad, but it wasn't as bad as up here. Up here was easily as bad as the Southeast. I mean, really, it was really, really, really bad place.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of Southern sympathizers getting even for things that
happen. I think so. Some of it is kind of a get even kind of a thing. I think so. Particularly, you know, again, in Shreveport, you know, we went and the day after Trump was inaugurated, Bruce and I rolled over to Shreveport for their version of the Women's March, which was extremely well attended for North Louisiana and Northeast Texas and South Arkansas. They said between 1,200 and 1,500 people, which is pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Shreveport has changed over the last century. They've got one of the three cities in Louisiana with a
African-American mayor.
A few protection, you know, local ordinance. And they've had people move in for the casino and for the movie industry. People in the movie industry aren't going to move to a place like Shreveport of 100 years ago, so they had to clean up their act quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people have become more emboldened, thankfully, and going and standing up against, you know, the Trumpism, but against everything else, all the corporatism and everything that's really keeping everybody down, so that just a few, you know, rich old white men can get rich, you know, get to be richer old white men.
Get richer, yeah, get to be really
richer.
Yeah.
And older,
gratify their greed and their bloodlust and their thirst for power. I mean, that's what they're all about. And so, so this, let's say we went in March, and it was in front of one of those monuments, actually, around the courthouse over there. And that thing, if it hasn't been brought down yet, it's due to be, you know, brought down at some point. They're going to pull it down. And that was by city, you know, a city council vote, and they said that it needs to come down.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Up on city property, and they say we're endorsing this. That's what they're saying.
There is progress along the way.
Yeah, and you know, it's typical because there's always, you know, good people that have always been there, always will be there, and they'll do the right thing no matter what. You know, I mean, and those people need to be highlighted instead of some of these knuckleheads that are out there. And
exactly.
Well, following World War II, you know, the GI Act, which was designed to get houses to white soldiers, veterans, there started to be the white flight, and a lot of people moved out of New Orleans into Metairie. A lot of people moved out of Shreveport into Bossier, and so the same kinds of people that put the monuments up are living the next town over. But they don't vote in the local election.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you don't count, you don't count. They don't have to listen to them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly.
The Metairie and Jefferson Parish, that's where David Duke's from. That's where the Vitters are from. That's where Steve Scalise is from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Really infamous Louisianans.
Yeah, yeah.
We haven't made a lot of progress there, but in other places we have, because some of the people that were keeping us from progressing have moved out. Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast.
Really appreciate it.
Really for doing
research. Wonderful.
That you did. I think it's a valuable service to Louisiana as well as your own family.
Go ahead.
Hopefully it will inspire some other people to go out and do their own family research. And
I tend to believe that the more particular a story is, the more universal it is, because it's in those details that people find something they can identify with.
Mm-hmm.
So what your family went through, that can help other people understand their own past.
And give people courage, hopefully, and boldness to, you know, pursue their family histories.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's some fabulous family histories out there that have not been told, and I'm interested
There have to be a lot of them. So if you're interested in writing, look to your own family. Sometimes it's you know, that interesting stuff is right there at home.
Yeah, and like I say, start like me. I just, you know, did an internet search, and then I started asking my old folks, hey,
right.
what's going on with this? What's this story? You know, and then I chase those stories down to the, you know, down to the ground.
Well, and most of us with kids have done that research project, you know, where find old family pictures and put them on a three-fold board. And
yeah, you remember the old plexi board, you know?
That you, oh, yeah, you totally.
That's exactly how I started. So
go in the closet. So dig through the closet and start back at it. It's a good project.
Yeah.
Well, thank
you
so much, Nick. This has been a great talk.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. And it was a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Well, have a good day.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to thank Nick for coming on our podcast and exploring his family's history with us. Certainly a lot of interesting research reflected in his book. And, you know, I'm sure that any of us that got started looking into our family history, there's something like the things he found there. There's a lot of diversity, especially in this state, Louisiana, above others. Well, for the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne. We certainly want to thank Nick for stopping in for the past couple of weeks, sharing his family history. We hope that this will spark some of you to go out and seek out your own family histories and kind of, you know, try to find out where you fit in. Because this is, as we said, this is a very, very human sort of search and a very human sort of need to find out who you are. So I want to thank Nick for sharing this with all of us and sharing it with all of you as well. And we hope that you'll join us for next week's edition of the Louisiana Anthology Podcast. Bye for now.